This is Dig Deep. It's the extra podcast edition having to do with political parties. Chuck has asked for it because he wants to talk about Trump with Aaron Brown. Chuck is our conservative commentator. Aaron is
overtime.
Yeah, this is the OT.
Well, we've danced
the liberal.
We've danced around this a little bit.
Yeah.
And I know like the we were going to talk about like fake news last time.
Yeah,
we really didn't get to it.
It's hard to avoid, really, in reality, in the real world. And here we can avoid it.
Right.
But in the real world, trying to watch Good Morning America or living and talking to people on the street, you cannot avoid talking about the president.
So here's, I hate getting stuck in the Trump vortex because Trump is just like clickbait for every media thing. So I want to actually like honestly discuss the Trump phenomenon to a degree. Because I admitted this to you way, way back. I did not vote for Donald Trump. I voted for whoever the libertarian nut job was.
Gary Johnson.
Yeah. Like, you know, I couldn't, there was no way I was going to vote Democratic. I am not a Democrat. And at the national level, I do not identify, but I couldn't bring myself to vote for Trump. I couldn't do it. That being said, I certainly felt the call. I certainly felt like...
Yeah, we talked about that.
Yeah.
There's like a primal call that he had there.
And it was... I mean, I would like to think that it wasn't like racism. Like, people would say, well, he's using all kinds of racist buzzwords. And I'm like, I don't have like that decoder manual. Like, I'm not hearing those things. But there were certain, you know, I'll give you one of the big ones. You know, the whole drain the swamp notion. The idea that, you know, there are people sitting in Washington... in, you know, the agencies just writing rules and regulations for all of us to follow who have absolutely no clue what life is actually like out here. There's a bunch of people sitting in, you know, committee meetings, appropriating millions of dollars for projects that are literally destroying our small towns. There's a part of me that like Drain the Swamp really spoke to. And in the lines of the conversation we've been having about the political parties, here's what I'd like to ask you. I feel like we have long needed a Trump-esque person, not him, but we've long needed someone who would come in and say, look, this Democratic consensus, which I'm going to call the centralization consensus, the idea that we should do everything out of Washington, D.C. If there's any kind of problem, we should have some type of national legislation to deal with it. That consensus, to me, seems very 1960s, very, very, very like pre-World Wide Web age. And if you take this analogy of the World Wide Web, you see that we went through a period of time where centralized servers was like the way to go. We had one big server. Everybody had like a really dumb terminal that you would tap into the big server. And then what people figured out in the late 70s and early 80s was that if we gave people individual PCs, they could do a whole lot of stuff themselves, even though that PC had a fraction of the computing power of the big central computer. I feel like our systems, and whether we go to environmental regulation, or whether we go to education funding, or whether we go to healthcare, what we have tended to do with the Democratic consensus is centralize everything into a bigger, more powerful, more centralized kind of system. And I am looking for someone to come and say, look, I care about the environment, but here's how I would do it in a decentralized way. I care about education, but here's how we would do it not in a centralized Washington way. And Trump is like kind of that person, like he's saying the first half of that.
Mm-hmm.
Is this something that you think could change the conversation in this country in a productive way? In other words, someone who wanted to take like theoretically Republican actions motivated by what Democrats talk about as main issues.
Mm-hmm. Well, so there's what Trump says and the image he cuts, and then there's the reality of Trump. And I think, like Chuck said, I think Trump's appeal to this day remains the idea of Trump, the idea of a guy who is is not beholden. Yeah, he's rich, but that means he's independent, right? And that means he doesn't have entanglements and he doesn't care about his own party. Indeed, he's proven he doesn't care about what his own party thinks of him. He'll tear them down on Twitter just as much as he'll tear down the Democrats, right? So I get that as the kind of a figure who might be a transformational figure. I mean, for liberals, a lot of people thought Barack Obama would be that guy. And for various reasons, Democrats would blame Republicans would blame Obama, but whatever.
I think Obama will be a historical figure, but not a transformational
figure. Not a transformational figure.
Right.
But I think he did some historically significant things that will, he'll be in the middle of the pack probably in the long run. But Trump, he won't be in the middle of the pack. He is a transformational figure in that I think our politics has transformed. And I think the idea of Trump is what had this kind of noble pretense for a lot of the people who voted for him. And again, I definitely didn't vote for Donald Trump. I view him, and just to kind of put this out there, I was horrified by Donald Trump. And I was horrified by the things he said and the way he divided people, the way he talked about women, the way he talked about anybody who disagreed with him was unacceptable to me, remains unacceptable
just
to me.
Debase the culture.
Yeah. And so there's that. But I want to talk about him not in terms of what I think of him, but in terms of what I think worked for him and what might be useful for political people to move forward. So a lot of people on the Iron Range voted for him. He carried a lot of range towns for the first time since Hoover, first Republican since Hoover. So he obviously appealed to people who had voted the other way the last time. And a lot of that had to do with economic messages and also cultural messages. And some of the cultural stuff was the race and the divisions over race and changing society and some of that. And a lot of the economic stuff, like the miners we talked about earlier in the previous episode, it was related to economics, the idea that here is a guy who was really going to do the tariffs on foreign steel. Who was really going to, he wasn't going to bust our unions. He was actually going to let our unions be and then keep us working by, you know, streamlining the environmental regulatory system that Chuck mentioned. And so that was the appeal. In practice, Trump is an imperfect figure because he is fundamentally a marketing product.
No, he's the modern P.T. Barnum. To me,
he's a circus master. Yeah. And so all of his positions are entirely malleable, and he does and often changes them in the course of a day. He'll have his staff say one thing, and then he'll come out and say the other thing, so that nobody knows what his real opinion actually is on things like, for instance, steel tariffs. For example, we get the notion that they're going to happen, they're going to be bigger and better than ever, and then Wilbur Ross goes on.
That was an impression.
It was a a loose one. And Wilbur Ross, his commerce secretary, who used to be a Democrat, who's kind of this steel, he's a steel industry guy, gets on, I think it was CNBC, and says, nah, we're not going to do that until the tax bill passes. And they're trying to ram around the tax bill through, but as we saw with the healthcare bill, we don't know what's going to pass. Maybe nothing. And we don't know what that means in terms of finish the bill. Does that mean the bill is written and then you roll the tariffs into the bill? Are the tariffs separate? So that's just one example of the guy is lying to the people who voted for him.
Okay, but what if someone appeared on the scene on the Republican side who said, like, I am for people who work in mines. Yeah. I'm for people who work
John
at
Kasich.
Holiday gas station. I'm for
John Kasich from Ohio, who is in a steel state.
Yeah, but I'm also against Republican regulation. I'm also against the centralization. I'm basically like anti-banker, which Trump is anti-banker.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
I'm anti like the kind of consensus.
The
centralization consensus.
But what do you think of his nomination for the Fed? I don't want to get into the
no,
weeds
no,
here.
It's fine.
But like he picked a guy who was really a status quo kind of candidate for the Fed. Now, I'm not saying for me that's not necessarily a bad thing.
No, but when Donald Trump was running for president, he said Janet Yellen and before him Ben Bernanke has artificially inflated the economy with loose monetary policy.
Right, but then he appointed somebody.
I totally agree with that.
Yeah.
Then he gets into office and he's like, hey, look at the economy is doing great. Yeah. And we need to get someone in here who's going to keep this party going.
And that's what he did.
And that's what he did. And I think it's horrible.
Okay. Well, but that's what I mean, though, is like you have the populist message right. that was effective because right. I think people wanted it.
Right.
And at least the people who switched from Democrat to Republican wanted it.
Right.
And were frustrated with the Democratic Party, which is very easily distracted by marijuana and variety of other issues. Not that I'm going to get the marijuana people on my case, but
no, but like
having had the marijuana people on my case, it's very frustrating when you're trying to talk about the life and death of your Iron Range community when somebody's obsessed with marijuana regulations.
Well, let me say it like this, and I'll get the hate mail then. Regardless of what you think about like transgender issues, it was very helpful to Republican candidates to have that be like a dominant issue mm-hmm. leading up to the you know election season. Not necessarily because there's a phobia against transgender people, but because it's a distraction against you know to core. And, I think what core Democratic Party conversation
and people's opinions on it are pretty fixed.
Yeah,
for the most part. Now, gay marriage being a classic example of how things can change over time, and that it was, you know, for me, I would consider it a good thing for my gay friends who can now get married and have a little bit more legal protection than they had before. But the thing is, if that's what we're arguing about, it becomes very difficult to win over people who don't necessarily or who are skeptical of that viewpoint. And I think the problem we've got is that because we live in a nationalized political environment where national issues or whatever comes out of the national structure gets to be the big issue, we have a hard time talking about the day-to-day, which does include the issues of maybe what to do with children who are transgendered. And these discussions need to happen, but they should be happening locally and they should be happening in a productive way, not in a let's label each other names and scream at each other kind of way. And what's happened is, and what Trump is the best at, I mean, the one thing I'm in awe of him about is he comes out and he decides to put a tweet out about some figure. Maybe it's a celebrity.
People kneeling during the
National NFL anthem. Thing is a classic example is he comes out and identifies something that he knows will create obvious division and will create political division along this normal fault lines, right down that fault line. Mm-hmm. And he's going to do it, and it's going to create a predictable reaction for him. I don't know what he gets out of that. I don't know that he can help it. It could be pathological, but maybe it's strategic. But whatever it is, it's perfect for ratings. It's perfect to get everybody in the country talking about it.
But you get the emails blasts.
Sure, from both sides.
Right. But I get, it starts out with Nancy Pelosi is doing this to you. And the other ones start out with, you know, Mitch McConnell's doing this to you.
It's all Trump now, believe me.
Right. But, it's all Trump now. To me, I feel like where we are headed as a country or where this thing ends up, you know, post Trump. And maybe it'll take another decade or two, but I think are you a Hunger Games reader?
No,
never.
This,
you read?
Hunger I have. Games? This can't be good, though.
I feel like we are going towards a Pan Am party, so a party of the capital, and we're going to a party of the districts, a party of the a party of the elite and a party of the non-elite.
An anti-federalist would say that. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I feel like that is where I sense that is, and I feel like Donald Trump is going to be a way marker on that mm-hmm. on that path.
Yeah, the thing about Donald Trump is that he is laying out lessons for other yes. people to follow.
Yes,
and
perhaps more principled people to follow.
Well, this possible. Is the hope, and also perhaps people who are just better at it, because in a lot of ways, he's consuming a lot of energy, but he's not producing a lot of results in terms of legislation or actual, you know, measurable things other than the churn and the sheer weight and gravity of the attention paid to this man. That's a model that could be followed by a future political figure.
I know we got to wrap up. I often wonder, and you might know this, Aaron, better than I do. I often wonder what the commentary was amongst Republicans who would do what we're doing now back in the 60s when Kennedy beat Nixon. Because I'm sure there was, I feel like Trump, the election of 2016 is going to be like cataloged alongside that election of 1960, where, you know, when you get a history of 1960, what you get is Nixon, sweaty Nixon, you know, with armpit sweat and like on TV, not looking good. I think in 2016, you get Donald Trump using modern media, Twitter, to set the agenda, you know, play like, you know, hey, look at this, look at this, look at this, to the media and really redefine what an election is. But if you look at the 60s, what came out of Kennedy was the Great Society and all these other like transformational changes that happened after him. I think Trump is like the to me, historically, like the turning point. And I'm really fascinated with what comes next. And I think it is.
May it come soon.
Well, it might come sooner than we wanted. And I think the way Democrats...
I guess, watch what you hope for.
Well,
I
the
guess
way
too,
Democrats because... want it to happen right now is with like a Robert Mueller indictment and upheaval. And I don't think that that's... I think if you look at this country as divided along those lines of... And I use the word elite. I know that like some people just have a visceral reaction to that. I don't mean elite like you're sitting there sipping wine and like your life is better. But I do mean like you're educated. You have access to jobs. You have savings. You have a certain amount of like stability. There is a huge percentage of our population in the country that doesn't experience any of that. And the solution of that group of people is to say, well, you need to become more like us. You need a more education. Mm-hmm. We're going to require you to pay for your own health care because you're just not smart enough to do it. We're going to do all these things. And I think that I feel like we're going towards a party of the privileged and the people like us three who are professionals, educated, have jobs, have options, have savings, and the people who don't. And Trump is speaking to the people who don't. And the Democratic Party is you know, kind of trying to, I think, speak about them, but is not really speaking to them.
And I don't want to make a partisan point off of this, so I'm going to start by saying that the Democratic Party is thrashing around, is adrift, and has all kinds of problems, and I'm not confident that they'll win anything for the next 10 years. So I'll start with that as my little marker saying that I'm not being partisan here. But I am saying that I think Trump is talk to talk, but is in fact going to hurt those people who don't have a party.
I will agree with you. I'm just saying I think he's created like the roadmap. Mm-hmm. And I think that those are the divisions. We talked about how in 64, the parties just like started to refine themselves along like the kind of racially conservative and the racially progressive. And I think that that is kind of being realigned now to be the party of the educated and the party of the non-educated. And I feel like that is what Trump has set in motion. He's not the right leader of it. He's not the person who's going to help, actually. I think people will look back and say, maybe they'll admire him for starting it, but I doubt it. He'll probably become a punchline to the next successful person to run that playbook. But I think that's the playbook. I think that's the playbook.
I would agree with the notion that the playbook is out there and that we're going to see some very unconventional, by our previous standards, candidates, campaigns, and elections for the next several cycles. Not only because Trump isn't going to be involved in the next few, or a couple anyway, but because this society is changing, how people observe information, share information is changing. We have foreign governments that are around and sniffing around and involved in the periphery of our whole system. We have a lot of things going on that I think will be regarded as a very significant historical period in the future. And a time of change and realignment. Since we've been talking about realignment, I think we watched through 64, something changed after 64. And I view this as kind of like, you know, the second gear of that change that started in 64. Now we're entering a new phase of this change.
This coming election will be a Democrat. I mean, it's an off-year election. The party in power always suffers a little bit. I think this will be a Democrat surge. I will acknowledge I voted for Rick Nolan the last two times. He's the only Democrat I've ever voted for in my life. I voted for him against Stu Mills.
You get to call him Stu because you knew him.
Yeah, I know Stu Mills, and that maybe will tell you why I voted the way I voted. So, you know, it was more of a, yeah, I mean, I know Rick Nolan personally, and I know Stu Mills personally, and I voted for Rick Nolan, and I'm not a Democrat. I've never voted for another Democrat in my life. I think that Rick Nolan is a really nice person, and I actually think he probably represents his district fairly well. I think in a Democratic surge year, I think he loses the 8th district.
Because of, and we didn't even get into the alignment of the DFL party in the 8th district. Because of the party going different directions. And it's really hard to watch.
And
as a Democrat, it's really hard to watch.
I'm not calling for that. And I'm not saying like this is the right thing that should
and
happen.
And he'll lose because of what ends up happening on his left flank.
Yeah, totally. That's what I think.
So, Chuck, I'm stuck on something. You're talking about the elites and the non-elites and what it may become, right?
Yeah.
Where do people who are not white, who are new to the country, do they automatically go into the non-elites, even if they are of means? Or
this is a fascinating thing, and I think that this is where it's going to get really. I think that is a really interesting part of it, because I think that there is a coalition of the non-elites that includes those demographics, largely people of color, people who are marginalized. I think that I can see them part of the non-elite coalition. I can also see the non-elite coalition being the Southern racists, if we just want to use Aaron's term from earlier, and in which case those groups are not part of it. Mm-hmm. And I think the Democratic Party right now at the national level has gotten to be a little bit lazy because they've been able to count on these broad swaths of people to support them, even though I don't think their policies actually align well with them. I think that, you know, the debate happening inside the Democratic Party is how much to become the party of social justice, as like the left defines it today, versus how much to become like the worker, you know,
economic justice
kind of party. And I think that there's a, I think that if the Republican Party wanted to go economic justice first, the true racists would have a hard time finding a home. And I think a lot of those people of color and minorities would find the Republican Party more attractive. And I think that's a basically I'm saying, I think that is a winning strategy for Republicans if they keep down the Trump road, the road that Trump started, minus
as Aaron explained it, the what Trump says compared to what Trump does, kind of a, is that what you mean?
Yeah. But I mean, I think that, let me say it this way. I think you can be, in the world we live in, this centralized, democratic kind of controlled conversation, wanting to have better immigration controls makes you like a racist and a xenophobe and like anti-minorities. I think there's a way to be thoughtful on immigration and not turn off people of color. I think there's a way to be thoughtful on, a wide variety of social issues and not turn off people of color. Oftentimes the Democratic Party doesn't let you do that. I mean, that's a, like, you know, a fine, and Trump has been nobody's friend when it comes to these things. But I think that there is a, I think that there is a path there to unite essentially around an economic message that would be really powerful, that would not necessarily be anti-Trumpian, but would have a very different emphasis.
There was a really great sketch on Saturday Night Live during the election, the Black Jeopardy sketch.
It was one of the greatest skits ever.
Because it was a Black Jeopardy, most of the contestants, the hosts, were all African American. And there was this one guy with a Trump hat
on. Tom Hanks
played the guy. And basically, they were running through all the categories, and it was all stuff that kind of indicated things in the black culture that are just commonly held, like suspicion of authority and looking out for your neighbors if the cops are around.
Have you seen this?
Yeah.
This is a long-running skit. I mean, they had Louis C.K. once play a black, black studies professor. And so it was kind of like laughed at, like, you really don't get black culture. But this one
has the Trump guy who basically, in the execution of the sketch, come to find out that he sees the world much the same way that the African-American contestants do until they get to the topic of race. And other than that,
the answer, like one of the questions was, you know, the answer is they want to give your Apple wants to have your fingerprint to make it easier to use your phone. And, you know, the Tom Hanks guy rings and he goes, no, that's how they track you down. That's how they get you.
And that's the exact right answer. Yeah.
That's the right answer. Right.
So it's this idea that talking about people of color and white people and them, whether they belong together in the party of the dispossessed. The reality is, I think the notion of poverty, the working poor who are working but not getting ahead, not having savings, that is a colorblind equation in this country. There are white people, black people, Hispanic people, Native people who are all defined in that category, and they're trying, and the country and their policies are not serving them. And whether it's a moderate or reform-minded Republican or some kind of transformative Democratic liberal or something, there is still room. And I think part of it is we need to stop thinking that it's a person who will do this, but rather communities of people banding together.
Totally agree.
To do something maybe at a local level or at a state level, or if it's big enough, a national level. But that's the kind of thing that needs to start happening. People need to think of it in terms of, what are we doing to serve these people? What are our policies doing?
I read a fascinating book about the culture of the South in the Civil War times. And it talked about the institution of slavery and how it really benefited the plantation owners, which were a really, really small minority of the number mm-hmm. of people in the South. And there were a lot of just poor white people in the South. Why would those people have gone off to war? Why would they have sacrificed their lives for this institution of slavery? And what the book kind of got into in the social aspect of it was that as long as you had slaves, you were not the lowest on the economic rung. There was always someone lower than you. And there was a certain kind of sense of security or superiority or whatever it was that, you know, no matter how far down you fell, there was always going to be this rung lower than what you were going to be. That's not the case anymore. Like, poor white people and poor African Americans are in the very same boat. And I think that a lot of the kind of social caste type things that existed that kind of kept us apart, those are largely going away. I mean, I don't want to simplify it down and say we voted for a black president and we cheer black athletes and we listen to African-American music and love it. But you know, African-American culture is not some obscure back alley kind of thing that, you know, people at church go, oh my gosh, did you hear that? It's mainstream part of the culture now today. And I think this gives us an opportunity to have really economics unite people, you know, more so than they've ever been before.
And there's two sides to doing that. One is what Trump did, and one is, I mean, I didn't vote for Bernie Sanders, but Bernie Sanders kind of was trying to do the same thing on the Democratic side. And those are very different sets of policies. that come out of those two different campaigns, but those are figures. And actually, a Trump pollster came out this week and said, we had the numbers. Had they run Sanders, we would have lost.
Right. I think that's true.
And I mean, it doesn't sit well with Democrats who have a divide in the party over that topic. And it doesn't sit well with the fact that there was a lot of misogyny and problems with Clinton, how Clinton was treated, I think, in some of the parts of the campaign. But that segment of the population looking at those economic issues aren't picky, whether they're literally socialist policies or some fairly right-wing policies that came out of Trump's campaign. It's all about who is going to serve us. And we'll go along with, we'll try your policies if you're serving our needs. And that's, I think, what's still up for grabs in this country.
This has been the Extra Dig Deep podcast. Extra, I like this.
Extra long extra.
If we have time again, let's do something like this.
Yeah.
Next time, it's going to be December.
Yes.
Let's do like an end of the year show.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know how we would want to format that, if everybody would want to bring like a different topic
top,
to the
top
table.
Stories or
yeah. But I mean, okay. I kind of feel like we should do a some type of... like year, I don't yeah. like those like year, you always get those year end shows that are kind of right. cheesy and stuff.
Right.
But I almost think like if we did one where we, you know, did like maybe the first two segments where we looked at like the last year, but then we look ahead mm-hmm. and say like, what, you know, what's happening? What's going to come out of
like, the coming McLaughlin year? Factor or what was it, McLaughlin report at the end? What's your prediction or whatever?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. McLaughlin report. Maybe not that.
All right. So if you're you're listening to this, you could send us some ideas if you'd like. Comments at kexe.org. Yeah.
I think in January we should talk about like women's issues. That would be
all right. Great.
Actually, I would love it if you had the analog of Aaron and I on the female side.
Yeah,
and,
which we're working on, by the way.
You know what would be really cool is if you did that and we had something along that to like all four of us sit down at some point.
That's exactly what Laura, who you met earlier, said.
Yeah. Campfire show, like where the camps would get together at summer camp.
There we go.
Yeah. I mean, I think
Boys
that would
be... Boys
and
Girls Camp.
But you have to get a real conservative, too. I mean, you can't get, you know... You got to get a real conservative. That would be fun. It'd be interesting. I would love to engage with someone.
All right. Sounds great. Thanks, you guys.
Thank you.